put those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move.
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Hello, I'm Herb, and welcome to Community Spotlight. Each week I try and bring somebody in from the community or an organisation or an event. And the event that we had a few weeks ago was called the Native Seed Forum in Yooralla. And I've had both Benjamin and Steve Field come in and talk about their involvement in collecting native seeds. And now I have Dave Carr. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Herb.
Well, thanks for coming in. Dave's a local ecologist and a friend of 2ARM, and I've asked him to come in and help me unpack some of these issues with native seed supply and the native seed supply chain. Now, you've been involved in this field for quite a while, Dave.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a seed collector myself, but I've also been involved in the research side of things. I used to run the Flora Bank program for Greening Australia, across Australia. And part of that role was working with the scientific community to get their research into the hands of seed collection practitioners to apply it and to make sure we got high quality seed. So I've been involved in that for a long time, and also do a lot of training. I train seed collectors around the country and set up training packages.
Well, we might talk about that Flora Bank a little bit later, because it sounds like a very important part of this whole thing we're going to unpack today. So tell me about the current process in which native seeds come into, I suppose, let's say, care for propagation and then the growing and then the conservation measures. How do they come in?
Yeah, so seed, in this part of the world, seed is collected from plants in the wild and mostly used in nurseries to grow seedlings, which you then plant out in your garden or on your farm. So the other way we get plants is by cuttings, but that tends to be just garden plants. So native seed is a really critical part of revegetation. And revegetation is used from gardens, farms, for conservation projects, land care type projects, but it's increasingly used for very large scale projects like carbon plantings. To qualify for ACCUs, Australian Carbon Credit Units, have to use local native species. So there's some very large carbon plantings going in on the tablelands. And native species are used for forestry as well, for hardwood forestry. So there's a whole range of sectors and projects that need native seed.
What's the limitations or the problems with the seeds and how they come into care for propagation in the first instance?
Well, one of the problems is that seeds are only available for a very short period of time, and that varies from species to species. So to get down to the birds and bees of it, a plant will flower. It has to be then pollinated, and then the seed has to be produced from the fertilised ovules in the plant, and that seed is then available to then fall on the ground or be distributed by animals or birds where it grows into a new plant. So a seed collector has to intercept that seed at the time when it's been fertilised and when the seed is ripe. So if you think of eucalypts, gum trees, they flower at a particular time of the year. It can take anywhere from 3 to 6 months for the seeds to develop. And then the seeds might hang on the plant for another 6 months, or they might fall off in 2 weeks. You look at something like a wattle, an acacia. They tend to flower. Most of our wattles are just starting to flower on the tablelands right now. They'll be pollinated and fertilised, and then they're usually ready sort of late November to early December. And most of the wattles that we collect all happen to ripen on Christmas Day for some reason or other. So a seed collector has to be there at that particular period to get the seed in the 1 or 2 weeks when it's ripe and it's hanging on the plant. It can be quite a difficult thing to get the timing right, particularly if the seed is 300 kilometres away and you drive all the way out there to have a look and it's not quite ripe, or it fell off yesterday. So getting the timing right is really, really critical with seed collection.
It's a narrow window is what you're saying.
That's right, yeah.
Very narrow window and very specific to each species of native plant that you're looking at.
Yeah, that's right. And some species like wattles, they're fairly predictable. You know, that you can sort of say that they'll be there for 2 weeks around, Christmas time. Whereas other things like native grass, you know, they're very responsive to weather. So if it's a warm season or a wet season, they will produce seed early. So kangaroo grass is a common grass across the tablelands, the northwest slopes. You can have ripe seed there anywhere from sort of late November right through to July. So you've really got to watch these things. Eucalypts tend to be fairly predictable, and the advantage of some species like eucalypts and some banksias is that they hold their seeds on the plant for a while. So you're not having to get there right on the day that before it all blows off. Or something like angophora, it tends to be ripe and then it falls off the next day. So you've really got to be lucky to get it.
So very specific, very tight time frames. Now tell me about the regulation. Like, how's it all regulated, or is it regulated?
Well, it's regulated to a certain extent where most people can collect common species for themselves for a small amount to grow some seeds in their backyard for their garden. But if you're a commercial seed collector or you're collecting for a project, you have some limitations on what you can collect. So obviously you can't collect from private land without permission of the landholder. That's just good manners. You are limited. You can't collect in national parks, for example. You can collect from travelling stock routes and state forests with a license or an agreement. But there are other limitations on collecting threatened species or plants that grow in threatened ecological communities. So threatened species are plants that are uncommon, in decline. And so you need a special scientific license to collect those, which protects them from overcollection or damage. One of the problems we have is with threatened ecological communities. Now, a threatened ecological community is a group of plants that grow together naturally, and there might be, you know, 100, 200 different plants and animals that occur together as that community. Across the Northern Tablelands, most of our plant communities are threatened ecological communities. So the whole community is protected by legislation under the Biodiversity Conservation Act. What that means for seed collection is that if I want to collect a common species from a threatened ecological community, I have to get a scientific license. So in this part of the world, white gums, Eucalyptus feminalis, it's a fairly common species in a community that's threatened. So I have to get a scientific license to collect that. The problem is that then I can't go back to the same place next year and collect the same species from that site. And I have to track that species right through from nursery right through to paddock, which makes collection of these common species almost unviable.
To me, that's a very difficult thing with the supply of a certain species, particularly where there's a demand for that species to repopulate an EEC, an endangered ecological community.
Yeah, that's right. So when
you look both sides of it, the supply plus the demand.
Yeah, so you look at something like Viminalis, for example, the white gum. That's one of the most common species planted in the Northern Tablelands because we're trying to restore these threatened ecological communities. So it's almost impossible to work under these license schemes. So what happens is most collectors just ignore the licenses. So that translates to large-scale projects funded by the government are mostly illegal because you've got all these people not collecting under a license and supplying seed for seedlings that are then planted out in these government projects.
So you just touched on the government projects. What are the range of projects that we're talking about that the seed is being supplied for? So land care projects are one. What are others?
Yeah, well, the for example, the Armidale Tree Group, which I'm involved with, collect seed to grow, which are then sold to farm projects. So farmers will buy, say, 1,000 or 2,000 seedlings to do a shelter belt. So that's a really common use, small-scale projects on farms, farm dams, you know, putting a bit of shelter around the wool shed, putting some shelter belts in the middle of the...
The koala pack, which is popular at the tree
group. That's right. So there's quite a bit of government funding now for koala projects where we're restoring koala habitat. Often projects are delivered through Landcare, where Landcare has a particular activity in mind. It might be protecting streams, or it might be habitat for koalas or regent honeyeaters or something like that. So there's a lot of big plantings going for that. And often these projects are funded by Commonwealth or state government funding, often through the Environmental Trust in New South Wales. That funding goes via Landcare, or it might go via local land services via the government agency, and it goes out to community organisations or farmers to do that planting.
So Steve talked about mine rehab and some of the projects that he'd done. So mine rehab's been around for a long time, and it's a government requirement for the mining company to rehabilitate the offset of land so that mine can occur. If you're trying to recreate what was there in the past in terms of the species and community, that's another problem in itself.
Yeah, that's right. So that gets very, very complex, because with a mine site, you're destroying the entire vegetation community. And often the requirements are that they put back something that's very close to the original community. And what that means is you're starting to get into species that are very hard to collect. We just don't know enough about how to collect them or when they flower, for example. They're difficult to store. They may have a very short storage life, and they're very difficult to germinate. They may have complex dormancies that require, you know, long periods of time or treatment with heat or smoke or cold to make them germinate. So you require a lot of careful work to get these species to germinate.
Just tell me about the RES, the Renewable Energy Zone. Is that going to be required? And it's a big push now to get this in the Tablelands, and there's a number of projects, both wind and solar. Where is the requirement for plantings there?
So the Renewable Energy Zone will cause the clearing of some native vegetation for power line easements or for wind towers or roads, batteries, and those projects have to be offset. So they have to create an offset by protecting an area of vegetation that's similar somewhere else. And quite often those offsets will require revegetation. So you need to do plantings to enlarge those bushland patches or to create new ones. So there'll be a demand for seed of a lot of these species right across the Tablelands for probably another 30 years to come.
So has government really seriously thought about this?
No. No, so this is the point of the Yirrala Seed Forum, was to try and work with the people in the government who are thinking about this. And believe it or not, the government isn't necessarily a seamlessly connected organisation, that one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing. So you've got arms of government that are trying to manage these offsets for renewable energy zones, like the Northern Tablelands Renewable Energy Zone. And you've got other parts of the department saying, well, hang on, you've got a really dysfunctional seed industry. Where are you going to get the seed from? And do you realise how much you need, and how you're going to go about it?
So just tell me, Dave, about Florabank. We mentioned at the beginning, and it seems to be that's the training and that's the way that the seed collectors are trained and to do the right thing in terms of protecting the communities and getting the seed into care. But can you tell me about the standards and where Florabank come from and its development over the time?
Yeah, so you might remember in the 80s that Senator Graham Richardson initiated a program called the 1 Billion Trees Program, and that was the start of trying to get revegetation happening in a really big scale in Australia. That was run by Greening Australia. It led to Greening Australia expanding across the country. It also led to the establishment of other organisations like Landcare. And in the early 90s, Florabank was a project run by Greening Australia with CSIRO Forestry to educate people about the best way to do seed collection in order to support this growing revegetation sector. So Florabank's been around for 30 years. It's had a number of different iterations and a number of different partners. What it did in the early days was it set up some guidelines for seed collectors about every aspect of the business. So how to collect seed, you know, which tools you use, plant identification, how you tell one species from another, how to clean the seed, how to store the seed, the best way to label and track the seed that you're doing, every aspect of the business. Now, it provided that support to community collectors right through to professional collectors. It also developed training packages, professional training packages for seed collectors, which we still use today. Now, those guidelines have recently been updated, led by Lizzie Commander from University of Western Australia, but it was updated with a feedback from seed collectors all across Australia, and I co-authored a couple of those guidelines, and that information and those guidelines and those training packages underpin the knowledge behind seed collection through Australia. So we're really fortunate to have really high quality standards and information to support seed collection.
But you did mention that if things become too difficult, because there's no regulation of the seed collectors, some of those fundamental requirements of flora bank are disregarded.
Yeah, that's right. You get people just doing bad practice in their seed collection. And bad practice might be that you're collecting the seed before it's quite ripe, or that you're not storing it properly. And how that translates into the paddock is that the seeds don't germinate, so you think you've bought a bag of seed. What you've really bought is a bag of dead dust that's never going to do anything, or the seeds are inbred so that the trees that they produce are never going to reproduce effectively. When you think of some of these eucalypts live for 600 or 700 years, you're investing badly in a very long-term venture. So without some sort of regulation to enforce the flora bank guidelines, you've got a whole lot of cowboys out there doing all sorts of dodgy things, and then you've got all sorts of people trying to do best practice and compete with each other.
So no uniformity in how it's actually rolled out. The more we talk about it, the more problems seem to arise. And I think we just might tie it up. There's two questions I have, which I'm hopeful that there is some answer, and maybe the seed forum in Yooralla might have turned up some positive approaches. But where do we go from here? And are there any ideas for the path ahead to sort of try and sort this out? Because, you know, you mentioned that 30 years investment in some of these renewable energy zones and these offsets and the mining industry might be for 30 years, but then you're talking about 500 or 600 years that the trees will live. So where do we go?
Yeah, well, there were two things that came out of the seed forum. One is the issue of supply and demand. So the demand from government-led projects is very up and down. So people invest in equipment and training, and then all of a sudden the demand's not there. So all of that training has to be done again 5 years later. And one of the things that we're pushing for with the government is to play a role in the market to have a steady demand for seed. And then the industry will respond to that and essentially solve some of the problems for themselves. If you know that you've got forward orders for 5 years, you'll invest in that piece of equipment that you wouldn't otherwise do. So there was a number of recommendations about how to even out the demand for seed so that we can, you know, then professionalise the industry a little bit. The other aspect was to form a professional organisation, so an industry association. So in Western Australia, they have the Revegetation Industry Association of Western Australia, which is a model for how we'd like to do it on the East Coast. And that's for the industry and the research community to organise themselves to push some of these issues, to run the professional training, to set up a code of conduct, to accredit seed collectors and provide that professional basis using the resources we've already got from Flora Bank and give the industry a way forward.
Well, that makes sense. Do you have a lead agency that might actually be able to take this issue forward?
No, not really. We've been waiting for somebody to take responsibility for ages, and to their credit, Biobank Seeds, the Fields, have really just taken the initiative to make this happen. And there's five or six organisations, including the New South Wales Department of Environment, that are prepared to take this forward now. So this is where the industry body will be the organisation that takes it forward.
So we might come back in 12 months' time, Dave. I think we'll wrap it up and see if we've had any progress on native seed supply and the supply chain and Flora Bank and all that types of stuff.
Well, let's hope so.
Well, thanks very much for coming in, Dave. It's a very important issue and I hope we can get it addressed. And that's Community Spotlight.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM 92.1 FM in the car and at work for great tunes and community news.